Good evening. I'm Dorothy Graves, a research assistant professor at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, and this is Science Cafe Little Rock. We are here on 89.1 KUAR, the fourth Tuesday of every month from 6:05 to 6:30, to talk about a science topic and give you the chance to call in with your questions. Our number here in the studio is 569-8494. That's area code 501-569-8494. And tonight, we are talking about polymer chemistry. Joining me in the studio, I have Jerry Darcy. He's professor of chemistry and director of the Center for Molecular Design and Development here at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Jerry, thank you for being here.
Well, I appreciate the invitation, Dorothy.
So to get our conversation started, what is a polymer?
Well, really, a polymer is when you take a small molecule and repeat it over and over and over again, and it becomes big enough to where we begin to refer to it as a polymer. There's no cutoff point where you can say, well, if it's below this number, it's not a polymer, and above this number, it is a polymer. But generally speaking, when the molecule starts to get repetitive, probably around 8, 10, 12 repeating units, we begin to start to call it a polymer.
What about sizes? I know we talk about things in chemistry with molecular weights. Can you give us a sense of the kind of size scale we're talking about with polymers?
Well, they really range from anywhere from a couple of thousand molecular weight units to could be in the millions molecular weight units. And really anything in between. And we do have polymers, both natural polymers and synthetic polymers that pretty much cover that entire range of molecular weights.
Now, do we know at what level we're able to actually see a polymer with the naked eye?
Well, of course, every time we look at a piece of plastic, we're looking at a polymer. Plastics are really a subcategory of polymers. You might call it the industrial polymers, and they're usually referred to as plastics.
How long have they been around?
Oh, they've been around since the early 1800s. 1838, I think, was the first time a polymer was actually identified as such. It was a fairly large molecule, and it was extracted actually from wood or cellulose, so it was actually a natural polymer.
What are some other natural polymers?
Again, probably the most common one is cellulose, because it is the thing that is the structural unit basically for all most plants and animals that we're familiar with, trees and so forth. Other natural polymers are things like protein molecules. Proteins do a tremendous amount of work in all living systems. DNA and RNA, for example, are also considered polymers, large natural molecular, what we call macromolecules.
So from a chemistry point of view, in terms of definition, is a polymer anything that, is a bunch of smaller units, joined together? Or are there certain types of connections that polymers have to have, or certain types of structures they have to have?
Well, they certainly have to obey the laws of chemistry. And so there is, depending on the molecule in the atoms that make up those molecules, determine what the chemical structure would look like. We have a lot of tools that actually can be used to analyze what that structure is. And we do a lot of the research that's being done in the area of polymers is trying to discover new ways to connect atoms together to make polymers. Sometimes you want a stronger polymer, so we spend a lot of time in what we call creating polymers that have branch structures and cross-link structures. Other times we want more flexible molecules, so we want to minimize the number of cross-links. So depending on the properties and the application that we want to use, very often determines what that polymer will look like.
If you're just tuning in, you have joined us here in Science Cafe Little Rock on this fourth Tuesday of November. We are talking about polymer chemistry, and my guest is Jerry Darcy. He is a professor of chemistry and director of the Center for Molecular Design and Development at UALR. Our number in the studio, if you have a question for Jerry, is 569-8494, area code 501-569-8494. Can you talk a little bit about how easy or difficult it is to build these polymers in the laboratory and what sort of tools you need?
Well, actually, some of the first polymers that were made were actually discovered accidentally. They weren't looking to be making a polymer or a plastic material. It turned out that when they did the particular chemical reaction, the polymer just naturally formed. So some polymers are very, very easy to make. One of the examples I can think of is Bakelite, for example. That was an accidental polymer that was made, and it was discovered that because of its properties, Bakelite was a very, very hard material and was easily put into constructive materials so that you could make things out of it. Like one of the first applications was like a cabinet for a radio. And also, I think there's an interesting story about how nylon came about. Prior to World War II, most of the materials that were used, especially in clothing, was made out of silk. And of course, silk was a very, very expensive material. It took a lot of silkworms to make just enough silk to make like one sweater or maybe one pair of stockings. And then DuPont came up with a process to make nylon. And that all of a sudden, you might say, revolutionized many of the applications that were used for silk and tremendously decreased the price. So it actually went from where, for example, women who only the very rich women in the prior to nylon being invented could afford silk stockings. But then after nylon was invented, it brought the price of what are nylon hosiery and so forth down to the price of the middle class.
Our number 569-8494 or area code 501-569-8494. If you have a question for Jerry Darcy talking about polymer chemistry on this edition of Science Cafe Little Rock. So did that creation of nylon really sort of push DuPont into the forefront of the industry?
That was definitely one of the top products that gave DuPont its heads up, you might say. There were other polymers that were very important in industrialization. For example, synthetic rubber. Prior to World War II, all of the rubber that was used to make tires and so forth had to basically come from rubber trees. And of course, during World War II, the Germans had basically shut down, using their submarines and so forth, shut down the shipments from where the rubber trees were, mostly in Africa, to the United States. And Goodyear actually came up with a process for making synthetic rubber, that basically eliminated the necessary step of using natural rubber for making tires. So that was kind of again, these are where some of these major corporations got their start, was with some of these beginnings of polymer chemistry.
Number 569-8494 here in the studio talking about polymer chemistry with Jerry Darcy. He is a professor of chemistry and director of the Center for Molecular Design and Development here at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. I want to talk a little bit about modern day applications. I understand there are lots of different ways that we use polymer in healthcare settings now. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, many of the polymer materials that we use in the healthcare industry are a result of, for example, some of the cardiac uh, devices that's used for making the valves for heart valves are a polymer. And of course, they have to have very, very specific properties. They have to be flexible, yet they have to be strong. And that's one of the applications that I'm very familiar with. Another application is something as simple as some of the methods that they're going to be using for actually distributing drugs. One of the areas that is, I guess it would be called a fairly new area of polymer chemistry is actually nanomaterials and nanopolymers. And those are starting to show many, many, many places applications that were not known until then. In fact, one of the most recent studies I've looked at is using nano composite materials for drug delivery, so that instead of a drug going, you know, where you take a drug and it goes out throughout the entire body, they can now use nanomaterials and nanocomposite materials, which are basically small polymers, and use those to actually deliver the drug to the exact site where the disease is actually present. This will probably revolutionize cancer treatment, I think, because they'll be able to target using these nanomaterials the specific tumors where the cancer is. It'll deliver a lethal dose just to that tumor and pretty much leave the rest of the body alone.
And there's a pretty broad research interest in this right now, you know, with different biotech companies involved in this and academic research and different funding organizations.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's going to really revolutionize, I think, many aspects of medicine. So
give us a snapshot of your research and what you work with in terms of polymers.
Well, I'm more of a person who actually models polymers in the sense that I try to develop materials, polymeric materials, which have not been synthesized yet, but would have certain properties that would be very desirable. Now, the normal process for synthesizing new polymers is it's a lot of trial and error. You try something and see what it, how it works, and then you measure the properties. But molecular modeling has the potential of going through many, many possible synthetic additions to a particular polymer, and then actually calculating what its physical properties would be. And then if you go through hundreds or even thousands of potential examples and find a half a dozen or so that actually meet whatever the criteria is that you're trying to, the particular properties of that polymer that you're trying to synthesize, you can then give those four or five or six examples to an organic chemist and tell them, look, focus on these polymers. Don't worry about trying to make the 1,001 potential derivatives of those polymers. So molecular modeling is really, really a very important and I think a very powerful tool to help the synthetic organic chemist perhaps narrow the number of possible molecules that he actually has to try to make and look at.
Our number here in the studio, 569-8494, area code 501-569-8494. I'm Dorothy Graves, and I'm talking with Jerry Darcy. He's a professor of chemistry and director of the Center for Molecular Design and Development at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. So you mentioned that, you know, you're trying to model this structure to achieve the properties that you're after. What are some examples of those properties that you're dealing with, the different types of parameters you're having to think about?
Well, one of the biggest areas right now that we're working on is we're trying to come up with new polymeric materials for used as membranes in the fuel cell development. Fuel cells have to have a membrane material that keeps the positive and the negative ions separated, but it also has to allow the free flow of these ions in order to make electricity. there's a lot of research that's being focused on these new membrane materials, and right now the limit for the amount of power that a fuel cell can produce is limited to the membrane material that is used in that fuel cell. So what our goal is, and I'm working with a team from the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, Dr. Simon Ong actually runs a research center in Fayetteville, and he is one of the people who is trying to develop new fuel cell. And so part of the things that he has asked me to do is to look at developing potential new polymer molecules for the membranes for these fuel cells.
So are you needing those molecules to join up in a different way or to be better conductors? Or what do you think is going to get you to that better membrane?
What we're looking at is we're trying to model how the actual ions flow through the membrane material. What happens is that you end up getting when you start getting too high a flow of electrons in one particular direction, you might say the electrons start backing up. There's not enough potential, you might say, holes that they can go through in order to complete the circuit. And one of the things is you have to balance the amount of electrons going through, but you can't let them go through too fast, because then you end up basically with what would be called a short circuit. So you want to maximize that. So the goal is to try to develop a polymer which has a balance between the ionic properties of allowing ions to flow freely, but not allowing them to back up so that they actually start to shut down the electric properties of that fuel cell.
So how easy is it to reach that? That golden space.
It is a difficult problem. That's why it's a research project, you know, because we're researching a whole bunch of different possibilities. You know, we use the molecules which have already been developed, and one of our first approaches is to see if we can take what's already developed and make modifications to that to see if we can enhance the properties. And we're making some progress, we think, in that direction.
So what type of instrumentation do you need to do the modeling work that you do?
Well, we have a host of instruments that we use to actually, you might say, map out the properties of polymers. Some of them use thermoconductivity. We use thermogravimetric methods. NMR is a very important process. NMR is a nuclear magnetic resonance spectrometer. And we use IR, which is infrared spectrometry. We use UV, which is ultraviolet spectrometry. Those are all methods that we use to analyze the structure of the molecule, the properties of the molecules, and so forth.
Our number, 569-8494, area code 501-569-8494. Talking with Jerry Darcy about polymer chemistry. He's the professor of chemistry and director of the Center for Molecular Design and Development here at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the issue with polymers in the environment. Certainly when you talk about plastics, you know, people always hear that that's, you know, a bad thing for the environment. Is that across the board, or what do we know about that right now?
Well, of course, plastics have been around for quite a while, and they really have revolutionized really the our civilization. There's so many things now that would not be possible without modern plastics. But of course, like everything, there's always a negative side to it, and you have to balance the positive aspects with the negative aspects. Of course, one of the big issues, you know, is of course polyethylene bottles, the bottles that they use for, you know, making you buy your drinking water in, you know, your the plastics that are used for milk jugs, the plastics that are used for plastic bags, you know, you get at Walmart and Kmart and so forth. And of course, all of those are very, they have certain properties which make them very useful for doing whatever the job is that we want. But at the same time, some effort needs to be made to make sure that we properly handle and if at all possible, recycle as much of these plastics as possible. Plastics are a resource that we can use as a resource and can be used and turned into all kinds of other types of products that would be environmentally desirable. I'm familiar with one company, actually, in Rogers, Arkansas, which actually takes polyethylene bottles, the milk jugs, the plastic bags, and they combine them with used wood products from paper mills and sawmills and so forth, and they turn it into a very durable and long-lasting construction material. In fact, if you made a deck out of some of these materials, the deck will outlast you. You won't be replacing a deck every 15 or 20 years. The decks could potentially last, as I said, longer than you'll last.
So I guess this is one of those, you know, can you have your cake and eat it too questions. But in terms of being cognizant of the environment as we're creating new polymers, do we know enough about how these polymers work and how they interact with the environment to, you know, try and move toward building polymeric structures that are also better for the environment?
Well, and there is, that's actually another big area of research, is to find polymers which will naturally break down, for example, when they're put into the environment. There are two things that you want from a polymer. Either you want it to be totally inert so that it never breaks down and causes any chemicals to leach into the environment, or you want it to be able to break down into products which are safe for the environment.
Well, Jerry, I want to thank you for being here. This has been a wonderful conversation. Just before we got together, I was looking online and looking up, you know, maybe some of the latest little news bits. And some of the headlines that I saw were talking about polymers that could remove mercury from soil and water, and a polymeric fuel additive that could reduce the intensity of post-impact explosions. And you mentioned the healthcare applications. Are there any right. others that come to mind that you want to mention real quickly as we're about to?
Well, I know that there are efforts, and I'm not sure exactly where they're at in these efforts, but there are efforts to add polymer additives to the fuel, especially in jet fuel, to actually cause that when the if a plane crashes, if the fuel tank busts, instead of spreading jet fuel all over everybody, and of course, that's where a lot of the injuries and deaths come from, is people being sprayed with jet fuel, and causing it to actually become inert and not be able to catch on fire at all. There's a major effort going on in that area, and I hope they're successful one day.
Well, thank you, Jerry. If you want to hear more from Jerry, we are moving up to the Afterthought in the Hillcrest area of Little Rock, and Jerry will be joined by Patrick Desrochers, professor and chair of the chemistry department at UCA, and Samir Jenkins, a postdoctoral fellow in radiation oncology at UAMS. Both will be expanding our conversation on polymer chemistry. So thank you, Jerry, for being here, and for 89.1 KUAR in Science Cafe, Little Rock, I'm Dorothy Graves.